history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. They won't call themselves that, but we can when we realize what they went through on our behalf. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along that journey, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, and so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Over the years on this show, we've heard from dozens of Pearl Harbor survivors, people who were there on Oahu on December 7th, 1941, when the world was forever changed. I've encountered them all over the country, Florida, California, Utah, Idaho, Hawaii, of course, you name it. And as we know, their numbers are dwindling, and before too long, there won't be any of them left to tell the story. We're going to hear three different perspectives from men aboard three different ships as we mark yet another anniversary of that day, which has lived in infamy. And of course, we owe that description to our 32nd president. Let's begin this special Pearl Harbor edition of Hometown Heroes with a listen to President Franklin D. Roosevelt's address to the nation on December 8th, 1941.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war or of armed attack. It will be recorded that the distance of Hawaii from Japan makes it obvious that the attack was deliberately planned many days or even weeks ago. During the intervening time, the Japanese government has deliberately sought to deceive the United States by false statements and expressions of hope for continued peace. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. Yesterday, the Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaya. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Hong Kong. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam. Last night, Japanese forces attacked the Philippine Islands. Last night, the Japanese attacked Wake Island. And this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway Island. Japan has therefore undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific area. The facts of yesterday and today speak for themselves. The people of the United States have already formed their opinions and well understand the implications to the very life and safety of our nation. As Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy, I have directed that all measures be taken for our defense, but always will our whole nation remember the character of the onslaught against us. No matter how long it may take us to overcome this premeditated invasion, the American people in their righteous might will win through to absolute victory. That I interpret the will of the Congress and of the people when I assert that we will not only defend ourselves to the uttermost, but will make it very certain that this form of treachery shall never again endanger us. Hostilities exist. There is no blinking at the fact that our people, our territory, and our interests are in grave danger. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph. So help us God.
So that was FDR on December 8th, 1941. Every time I hear that speech, I notice something that I hadn't really focused on before. Now let's hear from some men who were there at Pearl Harbor, starting with a guy I met in Bonita Springs, Florida last year. He passed away at age 94, about 3 months after our interview. But on December 7th, 1941, Russell Winsett was a 21-year-old from Alabama aboard the battleship USS Pennsylvania.
I was on a machine gun.
50 caliber?
50 caliber machine gun. Mm-hmm. I was up on the foremast because, as you know, the Pennsylvania had two big masts, and I was on the foremast in a nest way the hell up in the sky, and it had the stops on those guns so you couldn't shoot the guy next door, and it only had a certain area you could shoot.
The range of motion was limited, so
right.
You couldn't inadvertently
right.
Shoot your own ship. Sure. Kind of lead me into how that all unfolded from your perspective on that Sunday morning. Had you been up late the night before?
Were no. Well, our Liberty was up at, I don't know, 10 o'clock or something at night. But since we was in dry dock, we couldn't use the facilities on the ship. We had to go out on the dock. Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, I went out there to shave and shower and change clothes and all. That's when I walking down the dock, I heard the sirens go off, battleship, man your station. Mm-hmm. And that's when I rushed aboard ship and went up to my machine gun nest. Lo and behold, ammunition boxes were locked. And I said, I'm not going to climb that ladder back down and back up to get the keys. So I took what they call a dog wrench. It was a pipe about this long and broke a lock. Lo and behold, some young ensign in the Navy, he wanted to put me on report for destroying government property.
He didn't think Japanese planes coming overhead and bombing you guys was good enough excuse.
Huh? Right. So, anyway, the captain saw that what the report was, and he just shook his head, told it instant, beat it.
So you heard the signal for general quarters. You get to your machine gun. Had you seen planes in the sky? Did you know what was happening, or was this just chaotic?
Well, I could hear a lot, bombing and everything, guns shooting, but I had no idea what was going on.
Mm-hmm. I've talked to some Pearl Harbor survivors who said, you know, their impression was it was exercises. It was some kind of practice that the Americans were doing.
Right.
But you had an idea from all the noise you were hearing that this is for real.
This is for real because where we sat in dry dock was up above most of them in the water, you know. You could see a lot, but I knew it wasn't no drill. I knew it was for real.
So you man that 50 caliber machine gun. You bust open the ammunition box so you actually have something to shoot at them. And then what are you shooting at? What are you seeing as you look out on that scene?
Well, actually, I couldn't see too much because you had a band around you to hold you up to the gun. And I couldn't see much except when the plane would come in my scope there. I didn't know what was going on. I could hear a lot, and it was pretty scary.
As far as what that looked like, the number of planes that were coming through, or how much time you had to react if you actually saw something, I imagine there's probably nothing that could prepare you for that.
Well, you figure you see two or three come over and are strafing, you knew there's going to be more, so you just sit and wait for them. That's all we can do.
How close did those planes come to where you were?
I'd say some of them 100 feet, come right over the bow of the ship.
You could see markings on those Japanese planes?
Oh, yeah. I could even see the pilot with a Japanese grin.
You could see the face of the pilot?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I know that was a long time ago, long, long time ago. What did that feel like to be in that situation? Because now we look back and everybody knows, well, Pearl Harbor happened December 7th, 1941. But I can't imagine the feelings that must have been going through you because it was so unexpected for you.
Well, I'll tell you the truth. Believe it or not, I never got scared until it was all over.
Hmm.
Because it really didn't have time to get scared.
How long do you think you were there in that position continuing to man that machine gun?
Oh, probably a couple of hours.
Did it feel like longer?
Felt like all day.
Yeah, I bet. Did you come close to hitting anything?
Well, I could see it because on these belts that was ammunition was in, every fourth one was a tracer, so
right.
You could see where he was shooting. And I don't know if I sank any planes or not, but I shot any down, but I sure as hell hit a lot of them.
So you could see that you were scoring some hits.
Right.
And if you're firing away at this gun, I know the whole purpose of them being there is firing at you guys too.
Right.
How close did some of that incoming stuff come to where you were?
I really couldn't say because most of the damage was in back. I was up forward and it was in the back of the ship, and I don't really know what damage was done back there.
Well, I imagine you're so dialed in on trying to see what's in front of you and fire some ammunition that way that you don't have time to look back.
That's right. That's right.
And you just said that you didn't get scared till it was all over.
Right.
How did you know it was all over?
Well, they sound the alarm. It was all over.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, I climbed down out of my machine gun nest and went down below and saw them bringing people by that was in stretchers and all. It was pretty sad.
Had you gotten to know many men aboard that ship?
At the time, actually only people in my division. Because there, if believe it or not, if you were caught outside of your division, that guy put you to work. So we stayed pretty much in one compartment.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew quite a few people, and most of the people in my division I knew. Outside of that, I hardly knew anybody.
I bring it up because I'm just curious if you lost anyone that day that you had become acquainted with.
Oh, yeah. A friend of mine, he was from Orlando or somewhere down here in Florida. and he was the ship's photographer. And he had climbed up a leg of the mast. It had ladders on it, and they climbed up there to get pictures. And they shot him right off, killed him. That hurt me bad.
When did you start to grasp the magnitude of what happened there that day, not just with your ship, but the entirety of
it? Well, really, that happened about 8 o'clock in the morning, so after that, you had time to look around, and I'd say a couple of hours, you know, you could see the damage had been done, and you knew there was a lot of lives lost because those ships rolled over and were bombed and everything. A lot of people lost.
Can you paint a picture for us of what it looked like from your vantage point as you scanned the horizon, what you could see?
Well, it'd be kind of hard to describe, but out across the bay, or channel rather, we saw ships laying close to each other, some collapsed, some on fire. It was quite a deal there.
You could see smoke in the air?
Oh, yeah. Smoke and flames, and you could smell bodies burning. That wasn't good.
And I imagine that lingered for a while. It took a while to clean all that up.
Oh, yeah.
What were the hours and the days, maybe even that week after that attack? What was that like to be there for all of that? What kinds of things did you see and experience?
Well, they kept us pretty busy trying to get the ship back in ship shape. And they had our ship in dry dock was almost completed. All they needed was to put two screws on. They did that and flooded the dry dock, and we got on underway a week later and went back to the States.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever wondered? I mean, I just think about the ships that were sunk that day, those ships that were on Battleship Row. I'm just guessing that had you guys not been in dry dock, you would have been on Battleship Row?
That's right. Either they're out at sea, so I guess we were pretty fortunate.
Could have been a lot worse for the Pennsylvania?
Oh, God, yeah. If we'd have been underway or tied up there in the docks, we'd have been a lot worse.
What was the hardest thing for you to swallow as you saw and heard the stories and smelled that you just described and soaked in all these different things there in the aftermath of that attack? What was the hardest thing for you to come to grips with?
Well, the loss of life, mostly. That was hard to take. Because I thought that could have been me as well as those guys, you know.
Sure.
That was pretty hard to swallow.
How did it make you feel about the enemy?
Hatred. And it's still there.
I imagine there were a few things said about that among the ship's crew.
Oh, yeah. Lots.
Everyone that, you know, that wasn't at Pearl Harbor that I talked to, I asked them how they found out about Pearl Harbor. And most of them say, well, we heard the president's address on the radio. Did you guys hear any of that?
No.
In the years since, when you hear that speech, you hear the resolve reflected in that speech and the determination that this is what America's going to do. How does that make you feel?
Well, feel pretty good when they figure they're going to do something about it. Mm-hmm. And believe you me, we did something about it.
Yes, sir. That was the late Russell Winsett from the USS Pennsylvania. You can link to the full original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And we'll get another December 7th account when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you'd like to sell your low-mileage, well-maintained RV in excellent condition, bring it to Paul Everett's RV Country and they'll sell it for you. That's right. Consignments are welcome. Any type of motorhome, travel trailer, or fifth wheel. With 8 locations in 5 states, there's probably a Paul Everett's within driving distance of this radio station. Helping RVers get the most out of their RVs is another one of those things that make doing business with Paul such a unique pleasure. Paul Everett's RV Country in Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. For the exact locations, go to the website. That address is rvcountry.com. That's rvcountry.com. Over 55 years of experience and 1 million RVers served. Paul Everett's RV Country, proud supporters of Hometown Heroes.
proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Pearl Harbor edition of the show as we mark the 74th anniversary on December 7th. We heard how one sailor aboard the USS Pennsylvania experienced the attack. Now let's hear from Sam Freifield of Eugene, Oregon. He had been transferred from a destroyer to the light cruiser USS Detroit, and he was very tuned into world affairs. He was pretty convinced that America would soon end up at war.
I don't know what anybody else believed.
Right.
From my own observations, I could see that the war was coming, but I will not ever brag that I knew it was coming or anything. I agreed with the assessment of the big shots that it was going to be the Philippines. So when it did happen, I wasn't totally surprised.
Well, and it was the Philippines, too, pretty much simultaneously. But you didn't know it was coming to you there on Oahu. Yeah. So that Sunday morning, where were you? How did you realize that America was under attack? Walk me through those moments, if you can.
Well, I had slept late, and I was the last man in chow line. It was topside, and it was right up near the top of the ladder to go down to the mess hall. I heard an explosion, and I ran out to the rail. I looked aft, and the debris was still coming down. A torpedo had hit the Utah. Then I heard a plane. I looked out midships, and here was a plane dropping a torpedo in my lap. I don't know for sure what happened. In the book, it went aft. It went between us and the Raleigh and went up on the shore. Somebody else said that it went underneath, but in the official war diary, it missed, went.
So when you say right in your lap, you're at the rail of the ship, and you see a plane heading right at your ship?
Yeah.
And it drops the torpedo into the water right in front of your ship?
Probably 200 or 300 yards out when we dropped it.
Wow. So then you're just waiting for something to happen.
Oh, no. One doesn't wait. One runs to a battle station.
Yes, sir.
Post haste.
And where was your battle station?
In way aft in the chief's quarters. And we handled the ammunition for the surface guns. We had 6-inch guns. Well, since we didn't use the 6-inch guns for the air attack, well, I think there were 10 or 12, I don't remember how many men, 10 or 12 of us sat down there for over 2 hours chewing our fingernails. We could hear distantly the big booms of the battleships getting hit, and also the hundreds of rounds that of a 3-inch 50, we could hear that going off a huge amount.
But you guys needed to be there in case someone decided to use the big guns.
That was our battle station.
Right.
So when they said, load it up, well, we would have sent the rounds up to the turret.
And how did that work? How did you get them there?
There's an elevator, which was to prevent fires from reaching the magazine down below, and then to make sure that any explosion wasn't going to transfer from one end to the other.
Right. So that's where you were.
That's where I was.
For 2 hours.
For over 2 hours.
What was going through your head?
well, I almost got shot.
How'd that happen?
I worked in a pay office.
Right.
And one of my senior petty officers was Chief Grignon. I was in the chief's quarters. And all of those who had been eating jumped up and went to their battle stations. So the tables had this food on them. I had not had a breakfast. So I was reaching for a slice of toast on one table. And Grignon, who being the petty officer in charge of the group, told me to leave it alone. Put his hand on the 45. I went without breakfast.
I guess so. It would have been a real tragic story of the guy who died on December 7th because of a piece of toast.
Yes, that's one thing.
So when you finally emerged from there?
The first thing that they had us do, there were a large number of shell casings from the 3-inch 50 especially lying about on the deck. I and several others were put to work to throw them over. Then we were low on fuel. We had come in on Friday, low on fuel. We were planning to refuel. They said, no, come in tomorrow. But then they said, later on, they said, no, wait until Monday. So we were low on fuel. So now we were ordered, go over there and get some fuel. Then we headed out, going to the coast of the island to see if the Japanese were trying to land troops anyplace.
I want to ask you something. When you mentioned being low on fuel, and you alluded to the torpedo earlier, and you said there are differing theories on what happened with it, but if it did indeed go under your ship, the fact that you were low on fuel may have saved you, right?
That was my usual statement until a few years ago, especially after reading this. I decided, no, it did go between us and the Raleigh.
And explain to us where you guys were positioned that morning, because I'm sure some people maybe have been to the Arizona Memorial and they've seen the diagrams, or maybe they've read some books about it, but there are a whole lot of ships in a whole lot of different places. Where was the Detroit when this happened?
We were moored at Fox, what's called Fox 13, along Ford Island, which is maybe a half mile from where Battleship Row was.
Right.
There's the Detroit. The Raleigh, another four-stack cruiser, was behind us. Then the Utah and the Tangier. Now, this was normally a place where aircraft carrier would have been tied up. Mm-hmm. Now, aircraft carrier would draw more water than we would.
Absolutely.
So I, at one time, felt that both things, blow on fuel and being where a carrier would be, that pilot didn't know what he was doing. He saw a ship there where it was supposed to be a ship, and he dropped his torpedo, which was set to go low enough that it would get the carrier.
Right.
But it was too low to hit a light cruiser.
Especially one that was low on fuel and was sitting higher in the water.
Yeah.
So whether that happened or it went between you and the Raleigh, what you do know is the Raleigh was hit and the Utah was sunk.
Yeah.
So your ship was pretty fortunate to not be hit.
Yes, we were. Anyway, we left there, we fueled, then we headed out and went out looking, as I say, for the Japanese fleet or any activities. Didn't find it, came back in. We were there for a couple of days, and then we took off convoy duty, headed for San Francisco.
Well, and there was probably a scramble to get you out of the harbor so you wouldn't be trapped in there.
One of the things, it's reported that we went out there in a hurry so that any subs firing would not get us.
Right.
Well, we didn't get hit, so I don't know if they had any.
And even though you're out there looking for possible Japanese forces, you didn't find any. And that's probably a good thing, too?
Yes, because there was a heavy cruiser and a light cruiser and some destroyers.
So you wouldn't have been a very imposing collection of American forces if you ran into some serious Japanese ships. Oh, and while you were below deck, prepared to load that ammunition, you mentioned hearing the different things happening. And you heard the explosion that took down the Arizona?
Probably the Arizona. That one was a mighty one.
Can you help us understand what that did to your ship, to those men, to what your mindset now became in the wake of this surprise attack? Did it anger you? Did it motivate you? Did you notice something different about your ship afterwards?
I really had so little social contact that I can't give you anything more than my own feelings on that. A feeling that I said it was coming and it did. I knew that much. I just lived my life aboard whatever. I did whatever I was supposed to do, did it to the best of my ability. I did have to ask for the transfer in order to get promoted, so that's why I went to the Proteus ultimately. But as for the spirit of the men of the ship, I have no recollection of formulating.
Sure. No, and I understand that. And I'm sure you know why I'm asking, because, you know, it did have such an impact on the nation. And that rallying cry of Remember Pearl Harbor, and even the song, you know, that became popular, was something that galvanized not just the Navy, but the entire nation. So I was just curious how that worked for you, if it motivated you to fight this war.
I must have been a fatalist, because I just said, well, I joined the Navy to do whatever they told me to do. And if it said to fire a gun, I would. If they told me to pay off a couple of sailors, I'd do that.
It didn't stir big emotions for you.
Psychologically and philosophical thoughts were few and far between. I hoped that I wouldn't get into a battle. May I point out, side issue, other than that torpedo which was dropped and intended for our ship, I never got shot at again in the whole war.
How about that? That's not easy to do. So you had a big one coming at you at the very beginning.
The very first day, that one, and no more after that.
With the significance of Pearl Harbor, I'm sure that, you know, in all the reunions over the years, certainly you've thought about it. I'm sure that every December 7th, it's something that comes to mind for you.
I'm very sympathetic for what would be a huge group, people I never knew, but who were part of my life, too. In other words, the families of 1,100 men killed in one ship. I did have some thoughts about that. That was bitter, bitter thoughts. Thoughts of, oh, boy, I wish I had somehow known I could warn, but yeah, that was dreaming.
Yeah, and that was the Arizona. There's more than twice that number total when you think about the Utah and the Oklahoma and everyone else that was killed that day. Did you ever think that could have been me?
Oh, yes.
Torpedo did that for you, I guess, huh?
Yeah, that gave me a notice that it was possible.
Have you been back there?
Oh, yes, several times.
What do you experience? What kind of emotions come to mind when you go there?
The first time, an emotion of which included the 2,400. Then seeing that Arizona memorial said these guys deserved life, but they paid the price so that the rest of us could have life.
Amen.
That's about it. Now, the next time, my wife and I went on a cruise. We went to the islands. So, naturally, when we went to Oahu, I said, well, we're going to go out to the memorial. All right. We went out there, and I was the only visiting Pearl Harbor survivor. We got in line to get into the movie. All of a sudden, I had my hat on.
Your Pearl Harbor survivor's hat, sure.
All of a sudden, here's this other survivor comes running over. Come with me. Come on. Took me in, opened the door, hold it a minute. I got some important people here, he was saying to the other people.
Right.
Took us in, set us down, seats way up front. We got ready to go. I mean, got it all finished. He says, hold it. I got important people here. Took us out. These young kids are saluting me. And I was a chief. A chief, you don't salute.
Right.
But that's all right, son. But that was nice being honored that much.
Sure.
There I did feel sort of proud that I was one of those who put in four years to see that the people back there on the West Coast didn't have to learn to speak Japanese.
And to make sure that those 2,400 didn't die in vain.
They didn't die in vain.
And while we're on that topic, again, since we're talking Pearl Harbor, let's stay there for a little while. If you're down to 1,500 now, in a few years from now, it's going to be down to zero. What do you want the rest of us to remember? When you say remember Pearl Harbor, what is it that we need to learn from what happened all those years ago?
Just learn that it is possible for a group of people to lay down their lives, to offer at least their life, in hopes of preserving the country that they've grown up in. And the life that they have had and pass it on to their children, their grandchildren, and that's about it.
Well said. That is Sam Fryfield, still going strong in Eugene, Oregon, as he approaches his 94th birthday. When we come back, two brothers on the USS Oklahoma. One was killed on December 7th, 1941. The other survived against significant odds. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. If you're an RVer, you've probably heard about the new line of Grand Design fifth wheels, travel trailers, and toy haulers. What sets Grand Design apart is the long list of premium standard features you'll find on the entire line. You'll also find the largest selection of Grand Design RVs at Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states and online at rvcountry.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we did the Alamo. We will always remember how they died for liberty. Let's remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory.
Ah, the Sammy Kay Orchestra and Remember Pearl Harbor, a very popular song throughout World War II. We are remembering Pearl Harbor today. We've heard from sailors aboard 2 different ships there. One of the most powerful and emotional stories I've heard from a Pearl Harbor survivor over the years was in Lewiston, Idaho, when I had the privilege of sitting down with Richard Swede Artley. As it turns out, it was only about 2 weeks after our interview that he finished a long, brave battle with cancer. He and his brother Daryl were both aboard the battleship USS Oklahoma that day. Only the 1,100 men killed on the USS Arizona surpassed the Oklahoma's losses. 429 of her sailors paid the ultimate price that morning. Mr. Artley was very fortunate to survive, but he lost many friends and even a brother.
We had just come back from breakfast, and we thought we had something that run into us when the first torpedo hit. But the Navy says they're absolutely positive that 8 torpedoes hit the Oklahoma, and very likely 10.
Mm-hmm. How did you experience that? Where were you? And
I was in the steering room aft. I was just below the waterline. There were 8 of us in there. There were 6 seamen, a third-class quartermaster, and a first-class electrician. We had lights for about 10 minutes. Then the lights all went out. Of course, the ship turned over. to port 151 degrees, just a little bit of her bottom sticking out of the water.
And we've seen those famous pictures of the Oklahoma on December 7th. I have to ask, I haven't talked to anybody who was through what you were through on that day, to be trapped like you were, but as those torpedoes are hitting, what did that feel like? What did that sound like? And did you have any idea where you were or what was going on?
Well, I knew where we were, but I didn't know that we were gotten into a war. We just tried to keep from getting hit by things flying through the air when the ship was turning over to port. And I didn't do a very good job because we had a guy named Woody Havens, was a heavyweight wrestler. He was a second-class quartermaster. And he had all kinds of equipment down there, dumbbells and all that stuff, you know, to train on. And one of his dumbbells, I don't know why, I could never make myself understand what the heck I was doing in the telephone booth. But I had just stepped out, and one of his dumbbells came down and hit me in the leg. And they said, well, we'll get that fixed up. They wanted to do that in New London, Connecticut one time. And they wanted to do it in Norfolk, Virginia. And I kept telling them, I'll just tell them, no, I don't want any operations.
Did it break your leg?
No, it didn't break it, but I had 13 bones in there that sprung loose or broke loose. When we got, there was a line there, oh God, I don't know how long it was, of guys on gurneys waiting to go in the hospital to get an operation. And I kept thinking, well, when they get down to the door to put me in there, I'll just tell them no again. And I couldn't say a word. I just couldn't say a word. And they gave me a spinal injection. And doctor, every time he'd find a bone, he'd come around that little screen head in front of me and tell me I got another one, you know. And he did a pretty good job.
So this is all happening on December 7th, 1941, as a nation is about to realize that it's at war. And you were realizing it before pretty much anyone else. I mean, the very first torpedoes were hitting your ship, would sink your ship, and you're trapped inside your ship as it's turning over. When did you realize that you were trapped, and what was going on inside that room? What kinds of things were being said? Set that scene for us if you can.
I didn't know we couldn't open any of the doors in the steering aft, but they were all locked from the other side. If I'd have known that, I would have gone nuts. And so we just, hell, I slept some of the time down there. And the water was still coming in. There was a fresh air blower coming into our room because it was hot down there. Oh, God, it was hot. We just talked and didn't have a hell of a lot to say, really.
So these air vents are letting water in. You can't get out. So the room is filling more and more with water, less and less with air, and you guys are running out of time.
I think so. I talked to Jim Bounds one time, and I asked him, just a short time before he died, I asked him, I said, Jim, how much time do you think we had left down there before the compartment was completely full of water? He said, oh, I think maybe 15 or 20 minutes would have done it.
And how long were you down there?
Well, we got out about 6 p.m. Monday night.
And this happened before 8 a.m. Sunday morning when the ship was hit.
The ship had already been hit with all those torpedoes and already turned over. And they drilled holes wherever they had to get to us. We were very fortunate. We had two seamen on there that had gone to quartermaster school in the States before. They had just joined the ship about 2 weeks before the war started. And they knew Morse code. And they got, somehow they got to talking to some of these people. And they finally told him, don't talk to us anyway. We know where you are and we're coming as fast as we can. And when they did get down to us, they drilled these holes And they said, get ready to come out. When you get ready to take you out of here, just stiffen out. Because they had both sides of the places where they'd had those holes drilled. And they just passed us out of the ship. And it was a Liberty boat down there. And one of the guys, George DeLong, I think it was, he said, I was sure hoping I could go to Mass tonight. And this guy says, man, this is not Sunday night. This is Monday night.
So you guys didn't even know how long you'd been down there.
Oh, I didn't have a clue.
So I want to get this right. So you would have been down there about 34 hours. If this didn't, you weren't out of there by until 6 o'clock Monday night. You were trapped inside a sunken ship, running out of air to breathe, water filling up this hold. You were trapped in there for 34 hours.
That's right.
But you're talking about it like it's no big deal.
Well, it was a big deal, all right, because I knew if we didn't get out of there, we're done.
Did it help to have so many others in the room? You think it would have been harder if it was one or two guys, but since you had?
I think that we all pretty good friends, and we all talked to each other down there.
You said you slept for some of the time. 34 hours is a long time. I'm sure a lot of things went through your mind. Were you wondering where your brother might be?
Well, I knew where he was. He was in CIC, that's Combat Information Center, and that's right amidships. I was almost sure in my own mind that some of those torpedoes got that CIC.
And I want to talk about your brother more, but I'm really interested in how you survived those 34 hours and kept your wits about you. Was there anything that someone said or anything that was happening down there that you think buoyed your guys' spirits or made you believe that you could and would be rescued?
We all talked very positively. They'd get to us some way. Mm-hmm. Lieutenant Commander Hobby was the ship's first lieutenant. Well, that's old English from the old Navy. And when a disaster happens on a ship, the first lieutenant takes over. The captain doesn't have a thing to say. And he kept talking to us. And when he got down where we could talk to him verbally, why, we got our spirits up and we thought, now he's going to really get us out of here. And by golly, they did.
You're just 19 years old at the time. Were you too young and dumb to be scared?
Oh, I was scared. Oh, yeah. And you know, I'll tell you something very odd, and I think this is the truth. Of the 34 that they got out of that ship by just drilling these holes and getting them out through escape ways that way, I'm the last one that's still alive.
There are other survivors of the ship, but not other survivors of the guys who were trapped.
That's right. Yeah, the 429 were killed, but there were only 34 that were trapped where they had no way of getting out. I can't understand why we were so lucky.
And I'm sure after you got out of there, and 34 hours probably seemed like 34 days in some respects, but after you got out of there, you must have been awfully grateful to the guys who got you out. Did you have a chance to find them, to thank them, to figure out their story?
No, tell you the truth, I didn't. Not even one of them. Not even one of them.
If you had, what do you think you would have said?
I don't know. I would have, if I had a brain in my head, I'd have at least said thank you.
Well, you probably had plenty on your mind at that point, because
they got us out. They only got two more out. They were up forward, way up forward, but they didn't get it in time. That was the last two they got out.
I would have to imagine, I'm making an assumption here. I would imagine that in all the years since, it's been 70 years since this happened, that any time you see one of these catastrophes and they're searching for survivors, you probably want them to keep on going, huh?
Yeah, you bet. You bet.
When you see that, when you see, you know, Oklahoma City or 9/11 and these situations where the odds are long to find any survivors and they keep searching and they find someone, Does that bring it all back to you? Is it like living your experience all over again?
In some ways, it does. Makes me that much more thankful that they didn't give up on us.
From what I understand, you guys weren't just sitting around down there during all of this. There were a lot of things you tried to do to keep the water out.
That fresh air blower, we took a mattress off. They were only about 30 inches in diameter. And we rolled that up and stuffed it in there. It was a hell of a job doing it, too, because the water was coming in there pretty hard. Then we got clothes and skivvies and everything like that. We just damn near stopped that water coming in.
Mm-hmm. And that probably saved your life.
Absolutely, yeah.
One of many things that saved your life that day, and there are all kinds of reasons since then to be thankful for that. But I'm curious what the aftermath of it was for you, because you've just been through this ordeal that very few people in the history of the world can understand what it's like to be in. Did it take a while for it to sink into you what you'd been through, and how did you cope with it in the aftermath?
Well, I really can't answer that question. When Jim Bounds, that guy was, they took the Helen that had taken two or three torpedoes. And they had taken her there to the Navy Yard to have her fixed up. And the first night we got in there, Jim says, "Let's go ashore, Artley." "No, I go ashore tonight, not tonight." "Well, by gosh," she said, "I am." So I said, "Well, go ahead." And the next morning I was going to breakfast. He says, "Hey, sweetie, what do you think happened last night?" I said, "God, man, somebody from Mississippi, I couldn't guess what they did." He said, "What'd you do?" He says, "I got married." "You knew her a long time, huh?" "Yeah, a few hours," he said. "And you know, when they had that, we got the memorial for the Oklahoma finally was finished and up. And my wife said to me, she said, "You get yourself on a plane and get over there." So I did. And who do you think I ran into first that I knew real well? Jim Bounds and his wife Ruby, the one he married in, over there in San Francisco that first night he went ashore.
I guess it was a pretty wise decision he made after all.
Yeah, I guess it was, but Jim died last September.
Back in 1941, in the aftermath of the Oklahoma sinking, and obviously you get off of it, and you're rescued, and you start to realize, wow, our ship wasn't the only one. And in terms of the history, the Oklahoma losing 429 men that day was second only to the Arizona, which had close to 1,200 killed on December 7th. How did you swallow all of that? And when did you find out for sure that your brother was one of the casualties that day?
No one ever did come and tell me. I just had to accept that as I know Daryl didn't get through it.
Have you ever stopped and wondered what Daryl would have done with his life if it hadn't ended on December 7th, 1941?
Yeah, Daryl was one hell of a baseball player, good pitcher. He was on the Oklahoma team, and I'm sure he would have gone into pitching in the big leagues sooner or later. He was a terrific pitcher.
And I've talked to a lot of guys who didn't lose siblings in the war, but lost friends. And a lot of them felt like the life they led, that they couldn't take anything for granted, that they had to stay positive and move forward, because if their friends had lived, that's what they would have done. Did you ever feel anything along those lines, feeling like you had to live in a way that would have honored your brother's sacrifice?
I tried to. Probably didn't do a very good job. I used to think about him all the time, and Francis and Jack.
Your boyhood friends.
Daryl and those two friends, we'd known them all our lives. Now they're all dead.
And so too now is Mr. Artley, but his story lives on. A memorial to the USS Oklahoma was finally completed in 2007 to honor Daryl Artley and the 428 others who died on the Oklahoma 74 years ago. If you'd like to hear the entire original interviews with all three Pearl Harbor survivors you heard from today, head over to hometownheroesradio.com. And as anyone who was there that day will tell you, Remember Pearl Harbor. Keep America alert. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you once more that freedom is not free.